Today's Teisho is on case 54 in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 54 is entitled Umon Stretches Out His Hands. Engo's Introduction: Transcending Life and Death, Actualizing Zen Spirit. He casually cuts through iron and nails, lightly moves heaven and earth. Tell me, whose doing can that be? See the following. Main subject: Umon asked a monk, "Where have you recently come from?" The monk said, "From Saizen." Umon said, "What words has Saizen offered lately?" The monk stretched out his hands. Umon struck him. The monk said, "I had something to tell you." Umon now stretched out his own hands. The monk was silent. Umon struck him. Secho's verse: controlling the head and tail of the tiger, exerting invincible influence over the 4,000 provinces. How precipitous he is, the master says, one further word, I leave it open. So this is what is known as a teisho. In Zen tradition, we have this practice of teachers giving talks on Zen practice, and they're called teishos. The proper way to treat a teisho is to be meditating when you listen to it. So, you know, you should have your back straight, you should be watching your breath, and the center of your attention should be somewhat on your breath, somewhat on my voice. So, you know, the way to listen to a teisho is not the way you would listen to, say, a TED talk or a lecture, an academic lecture. You know, with an academic lecture, you're trying to sort of like soak it in or take it in, and you might be evaluating the claims that the speaker makes intellectually. This is really not the right way to deal with the teisho. You know, you should be a little bit meditating, really watching your breath, entering samadhi, and you know, the words have a different character when you hear them in that frame of mind. The content doesn't necessarily jump out at you, but the words will have a different kind of resonance or a different kind of meaning for you. So please treat teisho as not a lecture, but as an opportunity to meditate in a little different way. It's often the case that people have their deepest meditation after the sesshin, after the teisho at sesshin. So people will prepare for the teisho by sitting. Then that teacher delivers teisho, and then usually right after the teisho, people have the best sits of the day. So this kind of meditation, where you're watching your breath, but you're also listening to the sound of a voice, is really very profound if you work with it. The other thing you should know, or there's a couple other things you should know about teisho, what teisho means. It really doesn't mean lecture. It means offering, an offering. I was reading something the other day about the difference between an offering and a sacrifice. And I thought this was really interesting, because, of course, in Zen we call the talk an offering. And in fact, we make offerings on the altar to the Buddha when we have tea, and we take a cup of tea and put it up there, or we put a date. And this person was really an anthropologist, and she was saying that an offering is different from a sacrifice. Now, when you in classical times, people used to make sacrifices. So people would like slaughter a bull and sacrifice it to one of the gods, you know, or slaughter chickens and or doves, very common, like to sacrifice doves. And the anthropologist was saying this is contractual. It's kind of contractual, believe it or not. So basically, when you make a sacrifice, you're actually making a deal with the divinity, whatever that might be. And it's actually, the anthropologist said, you're actually putting God in your debt, basically. Interesting. So now God owes you, right? This is the logic of the sacrifice. Now this guy, this woman rather, could be full of hot air, but I thought it was a really interesting argument. So there's an element in a sacrifice of, basically one hand washes the other. So when I make a sacrifice to Zeus or a sacrifice to somebody, I'm putting Zeus in my debt. Now Zeus owes me. See? Offering, the anthropologist was saying, is different. Because there's no quid pro quo. See, you're not getting anything back. And in fact, the outcome of an offering is uncertain. So I just thought this was a splendid distinction. So in Zen, when the teacher gives a talk, the teacher is making an offering, right? And you're giving something, and you don't know what's going to happen. It's not quid pro quo. And the truth is, you will find lots of teachers in modern Zen who actually have like notes or even like a talk. They're sort of reading a talk, like a sermon. But actually, in Zen, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to read the koan, and you're supposed to be in deep samadhi, or you're supposed to have been in samadhi, and then you're supposed to just trust the process. Trust the process. And, what comes out might be massively incoherent, or it might be somewhat coherent, or it might be really coherent. You can't really control the process, but you're making an offering. You see, and in a way, don't even know what you're making an offering to. In Indian tradition, people when they greet each other, they put their hands together, their palms together. And namaste. One way to understand namaste is to say, I give myself to you. I give myself to you. And one way to understand teisho is, sort of like, I give myself to you. And I don't know what's going to happen, right? It's just the act of giving, right? Now, my personal feeling is that this is the ideal way to practice Zen. Because we could think of meditation practice also as a quid pro quo. It's like sacrifice. There was a guy in our group who no longer sits with us, who used to really punish himself on the cushion. So, he would sit full lotus many times. And after the sit, I'd say, how did your sit go? And he'd go, oh, I had a lot of pain. And I would say, well, what happened? What was going on? He said, well, when I pull my legs up in a full lotus like that, I have a lot of pain. And I said, well, why are you doing that? Why don't you just sit half lotus, or a Burmese style? It's more important to sit calmly than it is to, and I couldn't sort of induce him not to put himself in a situation that was painful. I think he had a lot of issues that he was working through. But I think some of it was like a self-punishment, you know, just like punishing himself. But I also think some of it was like quid pro quo. It's like, if I do this, I'll get that. You know, if I have enough pain, maybe I will have an enlightenment experience, you know. Or whatever he was seeking in his practice. I think some of it was that he was being hard on himself. And in fact, this person was hard on himself in a whole array of different things. You know, so he would be hard on himself in school. He pushed himself relentlessly hard. He was the kind of guy who, if he got a B on a test, would mentally flagellate himself, right? So his style was to sort of be a little bit masochistic. Right, but I also think some of what he was engaged in was like quid pro quo. If I suffer enough on the cushion, I should get something back. And other people might not practice quite that same way, where they're expecting something back, practice quite that same way by, say, pushing themselves to the point of pain. But I think many people practice, you know, as with this quid pro, their Zen practice is like sacrifice, not offering. So, you know, I have met people who have been practicing meditation for, say, 5 or 6 years. And I've met them and they will say things like, well, you know, I put a lot of energy into this and I don't feel like there's been a payoff. People actually say this, you know, I haven't had my great enlightenment experience. And I think that when people express that sentiment, it's a very human thing to say, right? It's very human. It's like a novelist who's written 3 books and can't get them published, right? You know, that's a very difficult situation. So you've gone to a lot of sessions, you've done a lot of sitting, and you haven't had daikensho. And you might feel like this is, you know, this really hasn't paid off. But, you know, in that kind of remark, you see something about the way the person has been practicing all along, which is looking for a payoff. So it's like a sacrifice, not offering. See, I think that if people approach Zen practice as sacrifice, it will never be very gratifying. And in the modern world, almost everything we do has this character, actually, of like this being like a sacrifice. So it's quid pro quo kind of logic. So I'll put in the extra hours at my law firm, and I'll be made a partner. And it hurts to do that, you know, it's difficult. Or I'll do this and this, and I'll get something back. This is sort of a very modern way of thinking. So this sacrifice logic is sort of very deeply ingrained in our thinking. But, you know, I think Zen is liberating when you don't expect anything back. The most liberating thing in the world is to do something as an offering, not as a sacrifice. It's the giving, I give myself to you, which is the liberating part. It's the liberating part. You know, if you come in and you sit down on a cushion and you're expecting a result, you know, you're setting yourself up for disappointment. Because, you know, meditation is very complicated. Every time you sit down on the cushion, you're going to have a different experience. It's going to be a different experience because, you know, every day is different. And when you come into the meditation hall at the end of the day and you sit down on the cushion, all of the life experience from the day is going to be present in your sitting. So you know, if you're really sitting, no two sits, no two meditation periods are going to be the same. And if you're expecting a certain outcome, you know, you set yourself up for a lot of tension and distress or a lot of disappointment. You know, and sitting in particular is a really like uncontrollable situation. It's like uncontrollable. you sort of launch yourself into the unknown. You're sort of launching yourself into the unknown, into like emptiness, or into mushin, into pure. You're launching yourself into pure possibility. And you don't know what's going to happen. That is what meditation is all about. Meditation, you could say, is launching yourself into pure possibility. And you, because it's possibility, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, we call it emptiness, but another way to think about it is pure possibility. So, when you sit on the cushion and you're saying, okay, here's what's going to happen today. You know, your mind is going to do something totally different. In fact, if you say that to yourself, your mind is going to revolt against you, and it's going to take you somewhere else, you know. And so, the best attitude when you sit down on the cushion is to just say, whatever happens will happen. You know, I'm going to make myself available for this process to work, and it's going to take me where I need to go, and I don't know where I need to go. That's the thing about meditation, is it's going to take me where I need to go. And if you practice in that spirit, right, I think you'll find every sit is deeply renewing. Deeply renewing. But if you practice with this quid pro quo mentality, you will find yourself caught in all kinds of frustrations. All kinds of frustrations. You know, there's a wonderful little story about this monk who was in a temple in China, and he was sitting, meditating like 18 hours a day. He would even meditate, he would be even sleeping on the cushion, and he'd still be meditating. You know, all the other monks would get up during the break periods and have a break. They'd go out and go to the bathroom, or they'd walk around. When it was sleep time, they all ran to their bunks and went to sleep. And this guy would just be sitting day and night. So one day, the master of the temple, the abbot of the temple, was walking by, and he saw this guy sitting alone in the zendo, in the zen hall. And he said, "What are you doing?" And the guy said, "I'm making myself into a Buddha." So the zen student said, "I'm making myself into a Buddha," the monk. So the master walked away, and he came back and sat next to the monk with a brick in his hand. And he starts polishing the brick. And the monk hears this scraping on the brick, this cloth scraping on the brick, and he opens his eyes and he looks over and he sees his teacher rubbing a brick with a cloth. And he finally can't stand it anymore, and he says, "What are you doing?" The teacher says, "I'm going to polish this brick until it's a mirror." And the student says, "You can polish that brick until the end of time, it's never going to become a mirror." And the teacher says, "Yeah, exactly. Exactly." So, when we are trying to have a result, we can't really have an authentic relationship with ourself or with the moment. We're imposing on the moment our expectations. And in that kind of a situation, we can't learn anything. Can't learn anything. The only way we can learn something new is to be confused and uncertain, right? And so, basically we have to allow ourselves to be launched off into possibility. And that means not knowing what's going to happen. So every time you sit down on the cushion and you're just going to be present with the process, open to what happens, this practice will be deeply renewing for you. Deeply renewing. But if you're trying to control your experience too much, you will be disappointed. You'll be setting yourself up for a lot of tension and distress, emotional distress. And I know this from my own experience. When I started doing Zen, I had read a number of books about Buddhism. And I had read quite a few books by a man named D.T. Suzuki, who was this very, very brilliant Japanese scholar of Zen. And in his books, Suzuki very much emphasizes the experience of Daikensho, Great Awakening. And so he tells many stories in his books about these monks who break through to this, you could say, like higher consciousness. And I read these books, and when I finally ran into my first teacher, this monk, Takabayashi Genki Roshi, I was very deeply excited by the thought that I could have some of these amazing transcendent experiences. And so when I would sit down on the cushion, I was constantly imagining myself in pursuit of these kinds of experiences. And I would go to our sesshins, these meditation retreats, and I was waiting and waiting and waiting for one of these experiences like the ones Suzuki would describe in his book. And I can remember many sesshins where I was sort of bitterly disappointed at the end that I hadn't had one of these amazing experiences. You know, I'd come to sesshin, I'd be working with my breath or working with my koan, I'd have a lot of pain in my legs, and by around day three it would begin to go away. And at the end of the sesshin, I always felt like I had been cheated a little disappointed. In fact, at one point I almost quit doing Zen. I actually thought, this is kind of a scam, or this is kind of a fraud, I kept sitting, and later I wondered, why am I continuing to practice Zen even though I'm not getting any payoff, right? I haven't had Daikensho. And it occurred to me, that there was some part of the experience of sitting for its own sake that I found deeply liberating, and you could say deeply therapeutic. Learning how to be open to the possibilities of things, so brings you so much alive, really, in a way I don't think anything else can. So I kept practicing, even though, I felt disappointed in not achieving these great insights, because I think on a deeper level, it was the most liberating thing I could do, even though I wasn't ready to understand it. I wasn't in a position to understand why I kept sitting. If somebody had said, "Why do you keep sitting?" If you're not having these deep breakthrough experiences, I wouldn't have known what to say. In fact, I probably would have been overwhelmed with anger or bitterness, But I realized later that this experience of sitting down on a cushion and just totally peeling back all of our expectations and being 100% present with the moment without any expectation is a really wonderful experience, really deeply deep liberation, I think. I realized this, after about 6 years of Zen practice, that, it's not the more transactional anything becomes, the more diminished it is, I would say. The more like a sacrifice anything becomes, and the more diminishing it is, the more that you're just trying to fulfill what you already know, the emptier the experience becomes. We experience things as alive or energizing, it's generally because we don't know what's coming. It's that openness that makes things feel alive. And there's another dimension to this problem. Let me go back to the koan. Umon asked a monk, "Where have you recently come from?" So I should explain that Umon Uman is his name, means cloud gate. Cloud gate is this very famous late Tang Dynasty Zen master. And he's the abbot of a temple. And a monk comes from another temple, and Uman meets him, sort of like an interview. As he's admitting the monk to his temple, he meets with the new arrival and interviews him. And Uman says to the monk, "Where have you recently come from?" The monk said, "From Master Seizen." And Uman said, "What words has Seizen offered lately?" The monk stretched out his hands. It doesn't tell us if they're hands up or hands down. Uman struck him. Now, you know, what does that mean? You know, there's some kind of an exchange that goes on here. And these koans are really like stories that involve encounters between Zen students and Zen teachers, or different Zen teachers meeting each other. And they're actually like subjects for meditation in themselves. They're not really like fables that are supposed to make a point, like the fox and the grapes, don't be too greedy. See, it's not like that. Koan is almost, basically koans have a kind of poetic quality or evocative quality. And we meditate on them, actually. Your teacher will assign you a koan and say, work with this koan. So usually in a koan, there's a phrase or a key word that you focus on when you meditate. And you could say, where have you come from? Could be the key word here. So basically this is a story about a monk who meets a master, and the master says, "Where are you from?" And the guy says, "I'm coming from Seizan's temple." And the master says, "Well, what does Seizan teach?" And the monk holds out his hands, and then he gets hit. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And when you meditate with it, you could say the koan is a little bit like a Rorschach blot. You begin to realize what's going on inside you when you work with the koan. You have no idea how many people come up to me after Taisho and say, "I felt that you were talking right to me." See, this is the character of the koan, that it allows us to begin processing in this very deeply personal way. Yeah, it's like a Rorschach blot. We see we look at it and it evokes whatever is going on inside of us, you know. So one aspect of Zen practice is this like transactional mentality that gets in our way. And that mentality has an even deeper, there's an even deeper problem behind that problem, you know. For many, many years, I have been reading about Zen teachers who go up into the mountains and do solitary practice. The most famous, the greatest Zen master probably in the last 500 years was a monk named Xu Yun, Empty Cloud. And Xu Yun was born around the time of the Civil War. He died in like 1958. If you do the math, he was more than 100 years old. And he was a really amazing Zen practitioner, mainland Chinese monk. And he spent many, many years in solitary practice, sitting up in the mountains. I have never understood that. You know, I've never understood that. Like most Americans, for a long time, I thought these monks and nuns who went up into the mountains were basically trying to find peace and escape from all the stupidity of the human race. Right? So in Chinese, there's a saying, in Chinese Buddhism, it's called red dust. Red dust. So, you know, basically, up in the mountains, the air is clear and clean. But down below in the city, everybody has red dust in their eyes. See, the dust is like the crap of everyday human life, right? The stresses and the strains, the competitiveness, the selfishness. Everywhere you turn, you see it, right? Egos clashing, people being petty. This is like red dust, right? And so, you know, when I would hear stories about people like Xu Yun going up into the mountains, I longed to be up in those mountains. You know, sometimes my life would get so confusing, and so I would be feel like a, you know, I had no control over my life, and I'd have a lot of anxiety, a lot of distress, and I would think of somebody like Xu Yun up on the mountaintop, you know, drinking water from a stream, cooking a simple bowl of rice, meditating all day, you know, and think, oh, if only I could be where Xu Yun was, you know. So I have, you know, for a long time I thought that these monks and nuns who went off and lived in the mountains were escaping from the crap of everyday human life and finding a place of peace and sanity, right? So, you know, I thought that way for a long time. And then, you know, I began to be a little bit, be a little bit negative about people doing that kind of a thing. Because, you know, so many Americans want to be, want to get away from, so many Americans, Americans are so, have become so individualistic, you know. So many people just want to practice by themselves. You know, they don't want to practice with other people. They want to go into their rooms and sit down on their own cushion and watch their own breath and practice with themselves. And it has occurred to me that this is, you know, this is really a very immature way to do anything, right? You know, I just want to be by myself. I don't want to interact with other human beings. I don't, you know. So there's a kind of escapism, I think, in this desire to practice meditation all by yourself, in your private world, right? It's like being on the internet all day. You can join Facebook and put your pictures on, and you can send people little messages, but you're actually not encountering any human beings. And you're not having any real human encounters that are uncontrollable, right? Everything's all carefully controlled, and you're in your little world. So, you know, if you were to ask me what's wrong with American culture, I would say Americans are too individualistic. You know, Americans are way too isolated. Way too isolated. Way too individualistic. We need more a community. We need more connectiveness. So, you know, it is always, I have always thought that these monks who go up on the mountain and meditate by themselves are really bad examples for modern Americans of what Zen should be. And I always tell people, Zen is about practicing together. But, you know, there's an aspect, I never understood why people like Xu Yun were going up into the mountains, because I thought they were going up into the mountains to get away from it all and to be free from human confusion. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think people like Xu Yun and these monks and nuns were going up in the mountains to free themselves from their desire for the approval of others. See? I don't know if that makes any sense. But you know, so much of what we do is about pleasing others, or being seen by others, or approved of by others. See? And I think these monks and nuns were going up in the mountains because they wanted to be free from that desire to be admired and liked by others, you know, which is actually kind of a prison, kind of a prison. You know, there was a very famous psychologist that I'm sure many people in this room know, named Maslow. And Maslow was a really innovative psychologist, and he came up with what he's called a developmental sequence, you know, developmental hierarchy. And, you know, and we grow up trying to, we grow up and we learn to become a self by trying to be like people we admire, or trying to be admired by people we respect. And we get mixed messages, so this creates a lot of confusion. One person says be a Republican, another person says be a Democrat. But Maslow said, you know, it's normal to imitate others, and it's normal to want to be approved of by others. But Maslow said, you know, ultimately, the most fully developed human being is no longer looking to others for approval. No longer looking to others for approval. Now that the man or woman who is fully developed is acting out of a kind of self-motivation. Self-motivation. Now, I actually think that Maslow is really very deep thinker. You know, that, you know, at some point you can't really be free, you can't really be creative, you can't really be a fully developed person if you're afraid of disappointing your ego ideals, you know, or if you're afraid of not measuring up to. And I think actually many Americans live this way. I think, you know, the internet actually makes it worse. You know, if you go onto Facebook, you know, all these people post pictures of themselves, and they're all basically desperately hungry for viewers. You want people to see you as you want to be seen by them, right? And Twitter is like this too. You know, there are people who have like 10,000 followers, and so you can Twitter and say, you can send out a tweet and say, "I'm having lunch. It's a big hamburger," you know, and your 10,000 followers, "Oh, dude, he's having lunch," you know. If you're an important person, you know, you might have a million followers on Twitter. Now, this is actually like really unhealthy relationship, don't you think? I mean, when you do things, it's normal as you are developing to admire other people and imitate them. And it's normal as you're growing up to want to be admired by people you admire. That's normal, that's healthy and normal. But there's something deeply neurotic in constantly, in every encounter, seeking the approval of others and only being real to yourself when you can see yourself in somebody else's eyes. See, that is a modern illness, very, very much so. You know, so I think something like seated meditation is very hard for some people because it means not getting that feedback, not getting that feedback, right? That you're no longer visible to other people. So, you know, part of Zen practice involves seeking approval. You know, when I met my Zen teacher, Genki Roshi, I had never met a person who had the same kind of affect, emotional affect. You know, he seemed to have a kind of confidence and resilience, and actually sense of humor, that I had never experienced before. I'd never met a person like him. And it was his personality, actually, in many ways, that got me interested in Zen. He had a kind of trusting nature. I don't mean naive, but I mean you got the feeling that, you know, he would just get up and go on. You know, he had this kind of resilience and openness that was visible or tangible. When I started studying with Genki Roshi, I wanted to be like Genki Roshi. And you'll see this sometime. You know, years ago, the Dalai Lama wears glasses, and the Dalai Lama wears glasses that have black plastic on the tops of the lenses. So if you see the Dalai Lama with his glasses on, he has glasses that have dark black plastic on top, and underneath it's like tortoise shell or something, a little lighter. And I began to notice that people like Richard Gere and Robert Thurman all had glasses with dark plastic on top. I began to see pictures of these, but those are the Dalai Lama's glasses. And that's totally normal, right? That's okay. I mean, they admire the Dalai Lama and they want to be like the Dalai Lama. But at some point, you know, at some point, you don't have to be approved of by the Dalai Lama anymore. You're in a different relationship with yourself and a different relationship with the world, you know? And that, I think, is a more mature place to be. You're not posting on Facebook desperate for somebody to see you, because only if you're seen will you be real, right? That's a deeply, deeply unhealthy mentality, right? So, one of the reasons we do meditation is because, you know, people we admire meditate. You know, and there is really such a thing as enlightenment. I swear to you, such a thing actually exists. And I know many people who have had that experience. I've met a number of really great Zen people, practitioners in my life. Both of my teachers had that experience. Other people they know and that I met have had that experience. So it's it makes sense to want to it be like them, right? But on the other hand, you know, if every time you sit down on the cushion you're trying to be the Dalai Lama, you're going to have an unhealthy relationship with your sitting, and you're going to have an unhealthy relationship with yourself. You know, at some point we have to do things in life that other people might not notice, but that we enjoy, right? That are fulfilling for us, that are enlivening for us. And I think this is very rare. I think Maslow put that person at the top of the hierarchy, and I think people are harder and harder to find in our very neurotic society. But I think Zen is all about producing that kind of a person. That is, Zen really sees that kind of person as Zen doesn't say actualized or fully realized, but that's kind of what Zen is trying to do. There's another story in Zen about a great Zen master named Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma was an Indian monk who came to China to bring Zen. He's the person who brought the Zen school from India. And he went on a job interview with the Emperor of China. So Bodhidharma came to China, and he was he had good references. He was very prestigious, very respected meditation master. And somebody set up an interview between Bodhidharma and the Emperor of China. And if the Emperor had liked Bodhidharma, he would have given him millions of yen, and he would have built temples for him, and he would have done many other things, but in fact, they didn't hit it off at all. The emperor couldn't figure out what Bodhidharma was talking about, and Bodhidharma left without any endorsement from the emperor, and he went up and sat in a cave for 9 years doing zazen, meditating. And basically, He sat there for 9 years, and what do you know? A student shows up. You know, he's sitting facing a wall for 9 years, and the perfect student shows up. The student is standing outside, waiting for Bodhidharma to let him into the cave. And Bodhidharma says, I don't know if you're really serious about doing Zen. So in the story, it's just a story, this young man cuts his arm off to show how serious he is about Zen. And in Zen art, there are many pictures of this guy with his arm cut off. And Bodhidharma says then, you know, you didn't have to cut your arm off. I just was looking for a person who doesn't seek approval from others. I'm just looking for a person who doesn't seek approval from others. Part of the reason sitting can become an obstacle is that we're expecting some kind of an outcome. We're expecting some kind of a result. Behind that expectation is a desire to be like others or be approved of by others. So when you sit down on the cushion and you have no expectation, this is your chance to be, to be at the top of Maslow's hierarchy, right? This is learning your understanding yourself, right? Having your experience of the breath, your experience of the moment, your relationship with the world. This is like truly liberating every time you do it. Now, there are stages. It's good to admire people who are accomplished. It's good to imitate people who are accomplished. And you need to have discipline. If you don't practice Zen, nothing will happen. But once you sit down on the cushion and you begin to work with your koan, you need to be unconcerned about what others might have achieved with this koan, and just begin to explore your experience of the koan. Umon asked a monk, "Where have you recently come from?" The monk said, "Saizen." See, the monk is still looking to somebody else for approval. He's still trying to get the approval of others. And Umon said, "What word has Saizen offered lately? So since you admire Saizen so much that you won't say anything about your own experience, what does Saizen say?" The monk stretched out his hands. He imitated Saizen. And Umon hits him. When the monk came into the temple and Umon said, "Where have you come from?" The monk should have said, "I just walked down the road and the sun was overhead and I felt so alive," or something. But he doesn't talk about that. He talks about Saizen, somebody else's experience. Umon said, what does Saizen say, since you determined to imitate Saizen? The monk stretched out his hands and Umon struck him. Then the monk said, I had something to tell you. It's like, finally. Okay. Umon stretched out his own hands. The monk was silent. Umon struck him. So the monk is still a little bit trapped. Secho's verse, controlling the head and tail of the tiger, exerting invincible influence over the 400 provinces. How precipitous he is. The master says, "One further word, I will leave it open." We all need language. We all need language, but at some point, what we say has to come out of our own mouths, and it has to come out of that uncertainty, right? Out of that openness, that pure possibility. So, Zen is all about sitting in that pure possibility. Every time you sit down on the cushion and expect something to happen, you're creating an obstacle for yourself. You know, be present with what's happening, be alert to what's happening. It's your experience.